interest in drugs, and becoming interested in drug addiction was very natural. And I was just interested in it.
Had you had any contact with addicted persons or?
None.
So it was an intellectual interest.
Yes. I don't consider myself only an addiction researcher. Mm-hmm. I consider myself a neuroscientist and neuropharmacologist. I happen to be funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and in that regard, I'm an addiction researcher.
And had you had any prior training in addiction research?
No.
So when you came into the field, can you describe the state of the of knowledge when you came
sure.
into the field?
And when was that?
Okay, I got my first grant from NIDA, or was funded by NIDA, first in 1972. And I came into the field then. The field was like, there weren't receptors at that point. We didn't know how drugs worked. There was no cloning. We didn't understand the molecular biology of proteins very well. The drug self-administration, that behavioral model, which is very important in the field, had just become established, really. It was just becoming available and known. I think that the biggest change that happened soon thereafter was the identification of receptors for drugs, the molecular sites at which drugs exert their actions. That started, my guess, it all started in 1973, I think, with the discovery and identification of the opiate receptor. Mm-hmm. There was no PET scanning then. There was very, very little or no brain imaging then. There were no brain banks. I was one of the first people to have a brain bank of any kind.
And can you describe what a brain bank is?
A brain bank is simply a repository, actually a freezer, where brains are kept for experimental purposes, so that you have access to human tissue. And the patient from which the brain was taken is well documented in terms of his medical history, whether or not he's an addict or she's an addict and so forth.
And how did you get that established?
I just started saving tissue.
And so you were a NIDA grantee in one of the earliest rounds of funding, right?
At that point, it was still something called ADAMHA, the Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Administration. It still wasn't NIDA, I don't think. No, right, I don't think it was NIDA.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you come in, you start doing, can you tell us a little bit about those earliest studies, like that first...
Yeah.
First round of funding.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember now. The first round of funding, I was studying something called cholinergic systems, the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, nicotine. Binds to acetylcholine receptors. And one of the first interests that I had was cholinergic systems in the brain. We knew a lot about acetylcholine in the periphery, for example, at the nerve-muscle junction, but we knew very little about it in the brain. And I started studying cholinergic systems. And I started basically first looking at the synthesis or the control of synthesis of acetylcholine itself.
And
because the receptors were still sort of not quite around.
Yes, right. And had you been focused on nicotine before?
No.
So why nicotine?
It was sort of, sort of a strategic decision. Here was a very important neurotransmitter system, but nobody was studying it in the brain, or very few people were studying it in the brain, and I thought that it was just a good opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, did you know Jerry Jaffe at that point?
No.
So you had the early studies, you think 1972 to when did you go to work at the intramural program?
1985.
Okay. So what I want you to do is try to catch us up on what the nature of your career was in terms of addiction research.
Yes.
From that early round of studies up to the point where you decide to go and become part of the intramural program.
Okay. While I was at Hopkins, I was part of the pharmacology department and part of the neuropharmacology division, I guess, the group, which was headed by Saul Snyder. And shortly after I got there, Saul Snyder and Candace Pert and others identified the opiate receptor in the brain. And that was so interesting. I mean, it was like sort of like one of the most important and basic findings in pharmacology, the fact that you can actually study, sort of reach out and touch a receptor. It just became very, very interesting and had a major impact. And at that time, I was focusing on neuroanatomy as a technique and an approach to studying the brain and how it worked. So I began then to study the distribution of drug receptors in the brain. One of the first publications was a Nature paper, I think in 1973, where we looked at the distribution of opiate receptors in the monkey and human brain. It's the first time something like that had been done. And that was very, very exciting. At that point, the immediate world started working on receptors, and very quickly, receptors for all the major drugs of abuse were discovered. There were the serotonin receptors for LSD. there were all the opiate receptors for opiates. Barbiturate binding sites were identified, or GABA receptors. Alcohol was still not clear. It still wasn't clear what alcohol was doing. So then I picked an area to work on that turned out, I think, to be very successful, and that was generally called the localization of receptors in brain. And I did it by autoradiographic techniques. Do you know what autoradiography is?
Explain.
Okay.
It.
Yeah. Supposing that this is a radioactive molecule of heroin, mm-hmm. or morphine, say. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's radioactive morphine. So morphine binds to its receptor. Mm-hmm. Now, you take a slice of brain tissue, and you put it against a film or emulsion. Mm-hmm. And when that radioactive molecule disintegrates, mm-hmm. the subatomic particle creates a mark on the film. Mm-hmm. Then you take off the film, you develop it, and the film is an image of the distribution of radioactivity in the tissue. And you can say, oh, look, there's 15, disintegrations in the cerebral cortex, and there's only two in the thalamus and nothing in the corpus callosum, and so you could find out where the receptors were. Mm-hmm. And that was first done by what we call in vivo labeling autoradiography, where you inject the radioactive drug directly into an intact whole animal. And the drug goes to the brain and under the proper conditions binds, the receptors bind the drug. Then you can sacrifice the animal, slice up the brain, put it against emulsion, find out where they are. So the first thing was in vivo labeling. labeling the receptors with radioactive drugs in vivo while the animal is alive. And I pioneered that, and early in 1974 was the first successful experiment. And that was with cholinergic receptors, receptors for acetylcholine. Okay? Because it's sort of what I had been working on. Shortly thereafter, in collaboration with Saul Snyder, we did the same for opiate receptors. We were able to localize opiate receptors in brain by in vivo labeling and auto radiography. Okay, that's one little chapter. Then, we kept trying to figure out how we could do this in humans, because you can't obviously inject a radioactive drug into humans, take out his brain, slice it up, and put it against emulsion. What we had hoped to be able to do was to take a human brain obtained at autopsy, mm-hmm. take slices, and label the receptors in the slice. And I spent some years trying to develop a way to do this, and then I took... I adapted, modified, and combined techniques that existed and worked out a procedure for labeling receptors in intact tissue sections in vitro. Now we're talking in the test tube. And this involved labeling or putting brain tissue on slides, microscope slides, and then incubating the microscope slide with radioactive substance like radioactive morphine. Under conditions such that you got a preferential labeling of receptors, not just non-specific things, receptors, and then taking that section with the labeled receptors, putting that against emulsion. And that was, I think, just a wonderful advance.
And what point did you do that?
That was, well, the first successful in vivo labeling was like, what was 1974? And the first successful in vitro labeling was 1978, I think. The paper was published in 1979. And this work was done with a graduate student named Scott Young. And he and I worked really hard for a lot of time with poor initial results. But we got there.
And this was also NIDA funded, right? Or was this...
At that point in time, I had two sources of funding, NIDA funding and NIMH funding. And as I recall, my cholinergic grant was funded by NIMH, and my work on opiates was funded by NIDA. I think that's the way it went.
And at that time, was your area of research, was it a research priority within NIDA, would you say?
Oh, yeah. Once the receptors had broken out, everybody got the receptor fever. And my work with trying to localize the receptors got a very high priority. There's something called K-Awards. Those are grants for salary. I got a 100 priority score on my K-Award at that time when I started talking about one of them when I was doing localization of receptors. So it got priority.
Yeah.
I was really excited. Okay.
Okay, so returning to the late 70s?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to... Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, the next thing that happened, and this was even wilder. So what we were able to do then, we were able to label and look at the distribution of receptors in human brain. Now, this is intact human sections. You could take a brain, grind it up, and find receptors. I'm talking about finding a receptor in an anatomical context. That's what these autoradiographic methods gave you. The anatomical context. You could say, oh yeah, the receptors are in layer 3, which is associated with pain or something, you know, that kind of thing. what we had now we could do animal brains, human brains, all kinds of receptors at the light microscopic level, and it was just wonderful. But to do human brains, we had to have brain from autopsy, mm-hmm. right? We had to have a post-mortem brain. Then something wild happened. People started talking about PET scanning. And we all said, what's PET scanning? Well, it's positron emission tomography. Now, I had been trained through college and graduate school, really, as a physicist. My undergraduate degree was in physics and philosophy, and I knew a lot of math and a lot of physics.
And where were you? What college?
College, University of Scranton.
I grew up in Berwick, very close to Scranton. University of Scranton.
University of
physics.
Scranton.
Okay.
Yep, physics and philosophy. I went to graduate school in Harvard in physics, then switched to Johns Hopkins in biophysics. Hmm. So, the way PET scanning worked is that if you injected a drug with a positron emitter like carbon 11, you could localize where that drug was in the brain by external imaging techniques without cutting open the head, just by putting the head in a very clever detector. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, in collaboration with Henry Wagner at Hopkins and his group, we formed a team. We injected, I think the first receptor we localized were dopamine receptors. We injected a monkey with carbon 11 labeled N-methylspiperone, and we were successful in showing that the drug bound to dopamine receptors in vivo in a living human by non-invasive techniques. And that was a little bit of a sensation. It was almost like, you know, Alice in Wonderland. Mm-hmm. There was an old Chinese mythological figure called Shen Nung. And Shen Nung was a physician who had a magical power. He could take an herbal medicine, and then he could make his body transparent, and he could point to where the drugs were working. And so here we were with PET scanning, showing where drugs were working. It was an absolute fairy tale come true.
Mm-hmm.
It was so interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. This is hardly remembered now. You talk to people who are doing PET scanning, they won't even know about these first papers. So that was, you know, quite an important breakthrough. Now, because receptors are on nerve cells, when nerve cells die off, the receptors go away. So these PET scanning techniques were first applied to neurodegenerative diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, one of my first patents was on a technique for diagnosing Parkinson's disease by using a brain imaging technique called SPECT, single photon computed emission tomography. Which was sort of easier than PET. And in people who have Parkinson's disease, their dopaminergic neurons die, and one of the receptors that's on the dopamine neuron dies off. And so if you do brain imaging in someone that you think has Parkinson's disease, that image will be faded in that area. And in fact, that works. The patent was granted in the early 90s, and it's now in phase 3 clinical trials. So that was one use. Then, now a receptor you know, a receptor is a place where a drug works, okay? Receptors are all over the brain. You take a drug, orally, it gets in your stomach, clean, the blood carries it to the brain, bam, the drug sits in a receptor, and that receptor is activated. Now, when we, so there's the natural substances, like the enkephalins or opioid peptides, mm-hmm. and there's morphine. When you inject radioactive morphine, morphine sits in that receptor, but it's competing for the endogenous ligand. It's competing for opioid peptide. So another thing that PET scanning of receptors gave us was a way to measure the endogenous activity, because it would be a competition between endogenous substances and the radioactive drug. That was kind of nifty.
Yeah.
And then the drug industry got really excited, because the drug industry realized that they could figure out what doses to give people. They figured out that they could determine what dose occupied receptors. Mm-hmm. And it was a way to figure out, you know, what dose to give for a new drug. That application is still a very, very important application of PET scanning today. For example, I don't remember the exact numbers, but antipsychotic drugs, when they're clinically effective, occupy a certain number, or a certain fraction of the receptors. Let's call it 60%. I don't know exactly what it is. For cocaine to be effective, it has to occupy, call it maybe 80% of its receptors.
And how widespread is that application today?
Oh, worldwide. The use of PET scanning and similar imaging techniques to determine receptor occupancy is still very, very much in use today.
Can I just interrupt for a moment?
Yeah, yeah.
No, this is all very, very interesting. But I guess the question I have is as a researcher, at each of these stages, when these breakthroughs mm-hmm. are happening, how do you imagine at the time the world post-breakthrough, and what that's going to look like, and what people will do with it, and how closely does your imagination at that point, in retrospect, kind of compare to what in fact happens?
We directly showed all these things I'm talking to you about. Mm-hmm. You know, we directly showed these things. I remember so vividly, we had tissue from a patient with neuromuscular disease, and you could see that all the receptors in the ventral horn of the spinal cord were gone mm-hmm. because all the neurons there had degenerated. I still have some of those images. They're spectacular. Still have a lot of the images on opioid receptors. So to answer your question, we became aware of these possibilities right away and tested them. It was easy to test them relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. It all happened very, very quickly, I think, in a matter of a few years.
Mm-hmm. So that PET scanning moment goes from when to when? What are the dates we're talking about?
Yes. I could get these exact dates for you. My best recollection is that maybe the first PET scan that showed we could do it was sometime in 1981, I think.
Okay. So that was occupying most of your time at that
point? Yeah.
It seems like you were very caught up in it.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. It was a tremendous time. I didn't know then how lucky I was, really. I think that, you know, lots of times scientists have one experience like that in a lifetime if they're lucky. Mm-hmm. And I just had them one after the other after the other. That went on for a decade.
Interesting. Do you think that there were any institutional or systematic sort of structural reasons for that, or was it really just luck?
It was a little of everything. The time was right for for people to identify receptors. The head of our group, Saul Snyder, was knew how to take advantage of an opportunity. The world understood it. I mean, it's not like Gregor Mendel, whose work wasn't discovered for 25 years or until after he was dead or something. But it definitely was a combination of luck and technology becoming available. PET scanners, in the configuration that we now understand them, I think was first done in like 1976 at the University of Washington in St. Louis. So we couldn't have done PET scanning before then. So you see, it was something that just had been developed and evolved. So a lot of things just came together at the right time. And, you know, everything sort of facilitates the next. Nothing succeeds like success. One thing goes right, people working here get excited, work harder.
So why did you leave Saul's group?
I left Saul's group because NIDA gave me a dream job, the opportunity to develop a branch, a neuroscience branch, from scratch with no need for grant money, all of it paid for. And the thing was from scratch, you know. So I went to NIDA, and we cobbled together a group of people, and we called it the neuroscience branch. It was like 15 people. And over the next 10 years, it had grown, really, to over 80 people, and half of them were PhDs, say. So within that branch, we had four labs, my lab, Edie London, Errol D'Souza, and then George Uhl. And one of the first things that I did when I went to NIDA, in my lab we identified the cocaine receptor, which was published in Science in 1987. So here was another one, you know, another winner. NIDA was so pleased and delighted, you know. And the cocaine receptor was the dopamine transporter. And so, knowing all these things that I knew about receptors and receptor imaging, we very, very quickly evolved a very powerful program to look at the cocaine receptor from a lot of different perspectives: brain imaging, molecular mechanism, cloning. George Uhl and I was a co-author on this study, cloned the dopamine transporter, and that was published in 1991 or 93, I don't remember. So things were just moving so quickly. It was, you know, when I was a new assistant professor, I gave a lecture at one of the most famous universities in the world. And I was scolded by one of the professors for talking about receptors as though they were real.
Really?
He said that everybody knows receptors aren't real. They're sort of mental constructs that we use to think about how drugs work. And that was 1973, I think, or 1973.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that.
And I can give you an interesting quote from a book, but I hate to hurt poor George's reputation. But anyway, and I don't mean to say he was wrong. I just mean to describe the environment and atmosphere at the time. Mm-hmm. There was bitter fighting about whether these binding sites really were receptors, whether they were single molecules. It was just bitter at times.
William Martin,
yes,
the ARC, had a hypothesis that there were multiple opiate receptors.
Yes.
That he had done, you know, really come about through clinical observation.
Right.
So is that part of that fight?
That wasn't part of the fight in the beginning. That became part of the fight. Everybody said, well, you know, hey, we know there's multiple receptors. Why can't you find them? Show me them by your techniques. And certain people did not believe in multiple receptors. But in time, it became clear that there were multiple receptors identifiable by binding techniques, PET scanning, and so forth. The world hasn't been the same since.
Mm-hmm. So how, okay, you're part of a paradigm shift.
Right? Yeah.
So how do you, when you're in the midst of that, how do you view, how does change happen? I may as well just pose my question to you, if you can make sense of it, right? How did that change occur? Was the evidence so compelling by a certain point, or did certain key figures become persuaded? How did that change occur?
There were a group of people who believed that it had to be true, had to be real.
And who were they?
Pedro Cuatrecasas. Pedro Cuatro, four Casas houses. Pedro Cuatrecasas was at the NIH and had identified the insulin receptor. Mm-hmm. He moved to Hopkins. Saul Snyder started collaborating with him. See how things started happening? Mm-hmm. And Snyder thought, I'll try and get the opiate receptor, but, you know, maybe. And then Avram Goldstein, he told everybody how to do it with stereospecific isomers. He told people how to do it, but technically he didn't do so well. And Snyder used the idea, got it.
Mm. And what about this
and was
other,
he, you know, Goldstein? Oh, Goldstein used
what
to
about,
review
like,
my
Kosterlitz
papers and kill me.
And
now, Kosterlitz, now. Mm-hmm. So, people for years had speculated that there must be an endogenous morphine. Why would morphine have an effect on you if there wasn't something in the body that made it possible? So Kosterlitz and others had thought there would be endogenous morphine. I don't know the history of that. Then the receptor was discovered, and again, that supported the idea that there must be an endogenous morphine. And so Hans Kosterlitz and John Hughes, working in Aberdeen, Scotland, after a long, arduous effort, identified factors from animal brains. Maybe it was sheep.
Was it guinea pig ileum?
Oh, that's some... I'm gonna get back to it. Yeah, maybe it was the guinea pig ileum they used to screen. But anyway, they identified factors, and Hans Kosterlitz says that one of the reasons they knew that there must be an endogenous morphine was the factor, the receptor. So that kind of fed in and helped that evolve. Now, Hans Kosterlitz, and I think he was like 56 years old when he published his ileum assay. It's a way to identify, you know, opiate drugs and... And that's always sort of inspiring, because when you're 50-some, you're often considered over the hill. But here's a story of somebody who did his best work when he was 56, went on till he was 80. You know, so he's a very, very exciting man. And
okay, so we've got the believers.
Okay, we got the believers. Saul Snyder was a believer. Mm-hmm. Pedro Cuatrecasas was a believer. And eventually, Lars Terenius in Sweden, Larsterenius, Lars Terenius. And then there's another believer, an important one. Eric Simon in New York. These guys were believers. And the drug houses, the drug companies said, well, I don't know, maybe it isn't receptors, but boy, it's darn pretty good for screening. You know, right. We don't care what it is. All I know is we can use it to screen for new drugs. And then Avram Goldstein, of course, I said he was a believer, didn't I? Yeah. So there were, now those are the ones that I recall were believers. These were, and I'm talking about the giants at the time. Yeah. I was a little puppy. So I'm talking about the people who were tall and big and gray. And, you know, I'm trying to remember who else. Gradually, people became converted. You know, it just happened. Oh, and another important figure. Oh, I'm remembering now. Bob Lefkowitz was a believer. Lefkowitz. He he identified an adrenergic receptor. He was a believer. And then Perry Molyneux was a believer. These are the first names of, you know, people working on it. There were others. I'd have to go back. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But these are the names that kind of stick out to me right now.
No, it's wonderful. So gradually, the sort of conventional wisdom, in a sense, becomes this.
Yes.
Right, so there's a
you go from fairy tale to reality mm-hmm. in years, a few years. And now, you know, 10, 15, 20 years later, it's like, oh, well, this, I mean, PET scanning always wasn't around, you know? Young students are amazed that cloning didn't exist when I was a young faculty member.
Right. Was there a loss or a you've described a kind of enthusiasm and a kind of scientific progress story. Was there any loss in it? When people talk about Lexington and Martin's work and that kind of stuff, they will relate a story of there was some loss because they lost their subject population when they moved to Baltimore, and you know there are different things like that. Was is there any?
I would say there were transitions, and some of the I think it was difficult for people who weren't in close to those advances to join in.
Mm-hmm.
Time marches on, there's new techniques, new concepts, new ideas, and to stay ahead, to keep up with things, you have to join in. And it's sometimes it's not always easy to join in. You may be geographically isolated or whatever, you know. And I think that was hard because pharmacology as a science took a giant step forward then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't call that a loss. I'd say it was a difficult transition for many people. Some people never made it, but, you know, people learn. That's the way it goes.
Yeah.
I don't know the details about why they left Lexington and came to Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Stories at the time were, you know, well, they wanted to be, they wanted to go to a city where there was a bigger addict population. They wanted to be near a good university, and the Snyder and his team with the opiate receptor and so forth and so forth. Plenty of addicts in Baltimore, blah, blah. So anyway, they wound up in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jaffe sometimes, he's the person, I assume, who
He hired me.
Hired you, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that for a reason. I mean, he obviously thought that your research area would help in some ways raise the profile of NIDA. And I think he sometimes talks about it in terms of what the ARC was doing had become more pedestrian.
Oh, yes.
The use liability stuff they were doing and
yes.
the pharmacokinetic stuff. That
yes.
that had become normal science, in a way.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. So you, that's an accurate portrayal.
Yes. I wouldn't denigrate it. I wouldn't say normal science in the sense of denigrating it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say there was something else to add
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
at that time.
So when you were brought in to do that, what were relationships like between the sort of, I mean, you must have been sort of newcomers, and then there were some old timers.
Like redheaded stepchildren rather than new children. Newcomers. yeah, I think that there was a lot of concern on the people who had been there for years. But, you know, there was concern on our part, you know. Are we going to be able to learn and understand these old techniques, these older techniques? Are we going to be able to work with these people, you know? I personally had never been a huge believer in behavior as a rigorous science.
Mm.
I was wrong.
Mm.
But that's what I, coming from math and physics, mm-hmm. that's what I thought.
Yeah.
And but I learned that I was wrong.
And at that point, would you say that behavior was the dominant paradigm in the field?
I would say the drug self-administration had captured people's imagination very, very much like receptor binding had.
Mm-hmm.
A thing about drug self-administration, one of the things that I think people overlook, really, is that it really was another paradigm shift because it showed that animals will take drugs. There's nothing intrinsically bad about this animal or that animal. Doesn't have a fight with his mother-in-law, right? Is not possessed by the devil. Every animal can't be a bad moral character, you know, because they're all taking drugs and pressing levers like crazy. And so that was, I think, a paradigm, very important paradigm shift for treating drug addicts. It was clear that taking drugs and seeking drugs was a capability of everybody and everybody's brain. That was a big deal. Now, what we did with the receptors is we got to the molecular mechanisms underlying that. So instead of looking at a moving, behaving animal and observing how much drug they were taking, we were looking at the molecular site where that drug acted. So we were sort of stepping into a new microscopic realm, so to speak, of drug action, drug taking.
Did you have the sense that you were that the field was going there as a whole, or were you sort of on the cutting edge of that, looking at molecular mechanisms?
Well, I'm sure we were on the cutting edge of that, you know. I'm sure we were. And, you know, they gave me a terrific job there and a great position, lots of resources. And it was a wonderful time.
It's been about 20 years now, right, since that?
Yeah, I went to NIDA in 85, right.
Mm-hmm. When did you leave?
I left NIDA in 95.
Okay.
In general, how does the generational aspect of this research work? In other words, do you see anything happen as a generation comes along for whom this is, in a sense, always been there, as opposed to a generation of researchers like yourself who are really, really making these breakthroughs? And now, I mean, you mentioned earlier that people don't know about the first papers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, is there anything lost there in the sense that people either forget or don't know things?
From my perspective, I think I see people reinventing the wheel sometimes, you know, having realizations that we had a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I guess that's the way it is, you know, I don't know.
Can you tell us what some of those are?
Oh, sure. I was at a seminar once, and people were studying, trying to identify PET scanning ligands, radioactive molecules for PET scanning for a certain receptor in the brain, and this person blithely said, and there are none that exist right now. Well, I had developed two of them. Other people had developed another.
Mm-hmm.
And so I casually said, well, that's not quite true, and then the person said, yeah, but they're not very good. And when I saw his data were no better than our data. So stuff like that. I mean, that doesn't happen that often, but, you know, that kind of thing happens.
Yeah. Is it sort of inherent in the nature of scientific inquiry,
it is.
I think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that discovery periods, I don't know, what will they last, 10, 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
And then they go sort of off into that gray unknown when, you know, people don't remember it anymore. And
have we had another since then? Or was that...
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think the next major breakthrough was the cloning of receptors.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to find the gene for a receptor. And then, after that, something that we would call signal transduction. So, when a drug binds to a receptor, there's a whole bunch of things that happen inside the cell. That's called signal transduction. Changing the signal from a chemical binding to a whole series of biochemical reactions inside the cell involving changing gene expression, changing the genes that are turned on.
Okay. All right.
So I think that was a major...
And is that George?
Partly George Uhl. A lot of it was Lefkowitz, Robert Lefkowitz at Duke. A lot of that was him. It was a lot of people. George Uhl, yes, he cloned the transporter, the cocaine receptor. Mm-hmm. But cloning had been going on a bit before that.
And, okay, so that's genetics.
And then it was my turn to play catch-up.
Right, right.
Whoa, what is cloning? Wait a minute.
Well, so genetics is another of these large sort of paradigm shifts.
Well, genetics, of course, has been around a long, long time.
Yes.
But with the advent of molecular techniques, people could use molecular markers, actual mRNAs, and looking at specific gene sequences as markers for genetic traits.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's genetics of alcoholism has mm-hmm. been around much longer than
yes.
genetics of drug addiction.
Right.
Why?
One, alcohol's legal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Two, even senators are alcoholics. Three, there's a big population. There are many, many, many more times people taking alcohol than doing heroin or cocaine. Three, or four, a lot of alcoholics are very influential and want to be cured and helped.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And now... Let's see. So you play catch up with the genetics stuff, and is that happening before you leave, NIDA?
Yes. Well, the cloning thing started. Yeah, I started adapting to cloning when I was in NIDA.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And tell me about that adapting.
Well, the actual nuts and bolts of cloning, for example, involved. Let's see. Technical things called plasmids, vectors, recombinant enzymes, a whole series of things that existed in other fields that hadn't been brought into
yes.
neuropharmacology. We're now being brought into neuropharmacology. We had to learn what the hell they were. How do you handle them? How do you store them? How do you make one? How do you know when you have one? How do you know when it's not working properly? How do you know if it's an artifact? So we had to learn all those things. And then there was this huge repository of genetic information into the gene banks.
Mm-hmm.
We had access to gene banks through computers. We had to learn all the computer programs that accessed the gene banks. We had to figure out how to use them. What do the words mean? And a lot of that stuff was just coming out. It was clumsy. It was awkward.
How do you compare the public investment in each of these breakthroughs? I mean, clearly there's some investment that precedes the breakthrough because people buy into the idea, the possibility. But then it's also very clear, though, that once something happens, then a lot of money goes into it. I mean, would
yeah.
you say it's a pretty comparable
yeah,
process?
Yeah, it is impressive to me.
Yeah,
how over the years, strategic decisions were made to support certain areas,
mm-hmm.
and I think they were good, wise decisions. And it's impressive to me that people had that wisdom to do that.
Hmm.
What's the source of the wisdom? I'm just curious from your perspective.
Oh,
how does
the recognition of the
yeah.
possibilities of the breakthrough, like the recognition that PET scanning could help us understand human disease and human drugs for humans.
Right.
I mean, you know, in 1981, how many PET scanners existed? Maybe, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
A dozen? 20? Now, there's 20 in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any moments when the strategic decisions were not right? I mean, where the possibilities were not recognized in with these kinds of areas?
The answer must be yes. I can't think of anything at this
moment. Well, the reason I'm asking is because after you left NIDA, I interviewed George Uhl.
Yeah.
And he talked about feeling under-supported
mm-hmm.
at NIDA in the
yeah.
intramural program
yeah.
doing the genetic stuff.
That's one of the things about intramural programs. Mm-hmm. I thought it was heaven. Mm-hmm. Turns out there are, you know, there are the great things and there are the not so great things. One of the things that's a limit is that, unlike universities, you can't raise money. You get money from the government. And that's all the money you have, what there is and what they give you. In a university, you can go to the government to raise money, go to foundations, you can go to private benefactors. So you're in the position where, theoretically, you can raise as much as you want, as long as you can raise it. And George, in the beginning, was not well supported, but believe you me, over time, he got fabulous support. Fabulous, fabulous support. I saw to it. Alan Leshner saw to it.
So you felt, though, that your research areas, you got the kind of support that you needed when you were in the intramural program, and you did not.
Yes, I got
confront those
the
limits.
Support I needed. No, I was not really confronting those limits. I had everything I wanted, mm-hmm. pretty much, to work out the cocaine receptor and explore the possibilities there and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So there aren't. You wouldn't look at the intramural program and say, "Well, there are these kinds of changes that might be more beneficial for the science that's done there."
I don't get your question.
You wouldn't. You've had extensive experience both with the intramural program and as an external grantee.
Right.
And you wouldn't now look at the intramural program and say, we ought to make these kinds of changes in order that a particular kind of science be better done there.
The intramural program is a great place. If you have support, you're doing things that the Institute likes and so forth, and you like that environment. I wanted more of an open thing, and this is off the record.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
off the record, you have to put your pen down.
Yeah. I'm marking it, which you are.
There you go. Turn that thing off?
No. Oh. Make me turn it off.
Well, you know, I think some people feel, not necessarily me, that the intramural research is very expensive because there's no leveraging. You don't ever get outside money and bring it in and so forth. There are no students, so there's no academic program, which cuts a bit into intellectual activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know. If you're working for the government, you can't write a letter of recommendation. Like, for example, I know someone who was applying for a job as the drug czar and asked someone to write a letter. This someone wrote a letter and caught hell because as a government employee, you're not supposed to write letters for support of government positions and all that. Mm-hmm. So stuff like that. In the intramural program, you are more restricted and limited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's true. For many people, their styles, their goals, whatever, it fits perfectly. There's a long history of many people who did fabulously well, Nobel Prize winners, Lasker winners, etc., who did fabulously well as intramural program people.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's go back on the record.
Yeah, back
and,
on the record.
Now, so you left, you went to Emory at that point?
Yes.
In 95?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Emory gave me everything that Hopkins wouldn't. An endowment, an enormous startup package, great lab space,
There's a few questions I'd like to ask, but I don't know if you want to. Well, I mean, I guess what I wanted to do was see if we could move this in the direction of thinking about your work and really others who are doing similar work, and how that translates into different arenas.
Sure.
There's two in particular, but let's start with just the translation of this research into treatment arenas.
Mm-hmm.
Again, sort of looking back retrospectively, how well do we take our scientific advances and then actually translate them into advances in treatment or other kinds of interventions.
Okay. So then we're not going to talk then about how I proceeded at Emory. We're going to now talk of...
Well, I mean, that's up to you.
Okay, let me just say what I did at Emory.
Yeah,
just,
why don't
sort of
if
go
you
on
like,
to that.
Let's do that.
My strategy when I went to Emory was built on using the human genome. The human genome was being done, and it was clear that this was an enormous opportunity. There's 30,000 genes in the human genome. We didn't know that then. Estimates varied from 30 to 230. Mm-hmm. But there's 30,000 genes, and we really only understand several thousand. We may not know the most important gene for drug addiction. We may not know the most important gene for pain or tolerance or euphoria. 10 years, we might know it. We might be having a completely different kind of conversation here. So it was clear to me that, you know, this information is piling up in computers, and so I decided to work on new genes that were involved in drug addiction. And I got so far as to work on one. I thought I would work on many, but one turned out to be so productive that I've worked on one for 10 years. And that is called the CART gene, C-A-R-T. It's a gene that we realize is heavily involved in appetites and addictions. And now I'm a molecular scientist who believes in behavior as being a great place to work. So that sort of brings you up to my... my new strategic plan, you know, has now gone from using the Genome Project to using the Genome Project specifically in the context of behavior, having behavioral models, finding genes involved in behaviors and stuff like that, which kind of was always there, but I didn't think of it that way.
And why didn't you think of it that way?
Because I didn't think we could ever understand behavior. I thought behavior was so complex that we couldn't really get a good handle on it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that way anymore. Mm-hmm. Very, very complex behaviors can be shown to be dependent on a single gene, for example. CART is a peptide neurotransmitter. The product of the gene, the CART gene,
right,
is a peptide neurotransmitter. So it's another endogenous signaling, you know, chemical signal, like opioid peptides, like GABA, you know, like dopamine. And CART peptide is, it's been a great living and a lot of fun.
And, Does it lead, in fact, to Joe's question about translation into treatment arenas for you?
Well, sure.
Is it
okay,
going
so
there?
Now, oh, it's definitely going there. Now, the CART gene is something that modulates cocaine. We know that if you inject CART into brain areas associated with drug addiction, you blunt or reduce some of the behavioral effects of cocaine. Therefore, the CART system is an interesting target to consider for developing medications for cocaine addicts. Now, notice I said that it blunts it. Mm-hmm. This could be key, because blocking something might not be something that people want. You know, you probably know about drug abuse treatment. People like agonists, they don't like antagonists. And if you're dealing with a system so fundamental as appetite and addiction, and they're intertwined, blocking something so vital to our survival is not going to get so far, maybe not. So, but CART doesn't block. It dials it down. It modulates it. It attenuates it. And that's one interesting aspect of the CART system. I believe, with my experience in the field, that CART is going to be very important. Mm-hmm. I believe that people, it's not obvious that it is, but I can see from what's happened. When I started working on it, there were 3 papers in literature. Now there's hundreds. And
when
I can
did you start?
I started working on CART peptide in something like 1985, 86.
So very soon after you left.
Yes. And I thought I would work on it and move on to something else and so forth, but it just got more and more and more interesting. And, you know, we just stayed there and continued to work on it.
And to do that work, are you funded by ONDCP?
I was funded by ONDCP when I first went to Emory to screen cocaine analogs at the cocaine receptor to identify potential medications. And that was a very successful program with Ivy Carroll. Mm-hmm. Carroll's his last name, two
yes.
R's and two L's.
I've seen him wandering around here.
Yeah. And that program has been very successful. We must have, I don't know, 10, 12 patents. Some of those compounds are being considered by NIDA, have been studied by NIDA for use as possible medications.
Is that the stuff that Jim Woods has been working on with?
I don't know.
I guess not.
I don't know.
It's an enzyme. So this.
Oh, no. Oh, the enzyme, the esterase that chews up cocaine that they found in the plants. Yeah, that's a fascinating thing, though. It's completely
different. Yeah, but it's different, right?
Okay. Very different.
That's what I thought.
But it could, you know, it could be a medication in a sense.
Mm-hmm. So ONDCP, you haven't continued with that?
No, that's correct.
Okay.
They evolved. They evolved to where they decided to cover big equipment rather than individual investigators.
Right.
And then with the new drug czar, I think that program has even been reduced.
Again.
So, you know, over time, priorities change, people change, whatever. Mm-hmm. But the ONDCP, Al Brandenstein, he did a fabulous job. He wasn't a drug abuse researcher, you know, he wasn't a biologist, but he was a very smart guy who figured out how to put money where it was needed, money that other people weren't providing, and he did. Now, I'm not saying that just because he supported me.
Right.
But I'm saying that because I really think, from my perspective, that he did a marvelous job.
So now you do more. Is it pharmacogenomics?
I would still call it molecular pharmacology. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the molecular basis of drugs on behavior. The behaviors we study are behaviors that have been around a long time. Mm-hmm. We're trying to figure out the molecular mechanisms underlying them. Mm-hmm. That's the frontier part of it.
And has your life as an external grantee, you now are NIDA funded mainly.
Yes.
And that, was it what you thought it would be when you
sure.
left?
Sure. Oh, I knew what it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you had another question following on the translation one?
Well, I mean, again, just talking about how these things translate, I mean, how does all of this work, in your view, translate into the popular imagination?
Oh, into the popular imagination.
Yeah.
Well, what is very popular and attractive is brain imaging. Mm-hmm. You show people a brain.
Yeah.
Colors. Mm-hmm. This is the way it looks normal. This is the way it looks on drugs. And they can relate to that.
Yeah.
They don't know from nothing about recombinant enzymes or, you know, allosteric transitions of receptor proteins. You know. And even if you showed them a picture of it, they wouldn't, you know.
Yeah.
You show them a picture of a brain with a black or orange wave in it, it's like, whoa, I kind of get that idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been a very powerful tool in conveying the advances we've made. Not fully conveying it, but nevertheless a powerful tool. There's nothing like a picture. Now, the drug industry, they have benefited incredibly from this. The screen, you know, for example, supposing this is an opiate receptor, this is an opiate drug. I can screen by doing competition. Supposing I have 100,000 new compounds that have never been tested before, and I want to find out if there's any opiate-like compounds in that library. I just start screening them in this binding assay. Any drug that knocks off this radioactive molecule is an opiate because it's binding to the opiate receptor. So the drug industry has 50, 60 receptors they can screen. In a day, they can find out what the molecular profile is of a potential drug. They can find out if this new drug, say you were making antipsychotic drugs. Okay, it binds to the dopamine receptor. That's an antipsychotic drug. They can also test for side effects. Does it bind to the histamine receptor? If it does, people are going to find this drug sedating. Does it bind to the noradrenergic receptor? If it does, it might lower blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the receptor binding was a revolution in pharmacology, in my opinion, that was a huge step forward. It was a big, big paradigm shift.
And your view of it, I believe you said earlier, is that the industry recognized this almost immediately.
Yeah.
Is that right?
So did the FDA, I think. And the FDA started, I think now they probably require a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
But the brain imaging stuff is wonderful for the public. A big deal. Well, there have been several key findings, I think, that have changed the face of understanding addiction. Mm-hmm. One I talked about was the fact that animals self-administer drugs. So somehow in the brain is a system, a capability for wanting drugs of a certain type. Now, in the brain is a reward system. This system is there in everybody, and its purpose is to make you repeat what you've done if it turns on this system. It reinforces certain actions. The things that it reinforces turn out to be things that are good for your survival. Food, water, salt, sex, those things are turned on by the reward system. If we didn't have reward systems, we'd have been gone a long time ago. Reward system is a secret to life. Okay? Now, given that there's millions and billions of chemical compounds on this earth, it isn't surprising that some few are going to activate that reward system, maybe by mistake, just by chance. Those things are the drugs. They turn out to be abused drugs. They activate that reward system, the reinforcing system. So understanding that there is this naturally occurring system in the brain, the view of drug addiction has changed tremendously. It's now physiologically based. This is a brain disorder. Because it's physiologically based in a brain disorder like Parkinson's disease, we can develop medications now to treat these things. And treatment is a lot more effective and cheaper than incarceration, maybe.
So the redefinition of addiction as a chronic relapsing brain disorder, that's what you're talking about.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
And that was good for the field in terms of...
But I'm not finished. There's one couple other things. Mm-hmm. So the awareness that there is this endogenous system was a big deal. It was a big deal to me, you know, like, well, this is where we have to work. Now, do you realize, just think about it, how many or the breadth and all the different kinds of medical morbidity are associated with the reward system? There's not only drugs of abuse. There's cancer because of smoking, liver disease because of alcohol, type 2 diabetes because of overeating, all sorts of cardiovascular disease because of body weight and food intake. So the reward system, while we think of it as something specifically related to drug addiction, it is in fact a major biological system in the medical field underlying a lot of morbidity that goes way, way beyond drug abuse. But that's just, let me get to one thing I want to talk about. One of the major discoveries was that, well, let's see, it goes like this. When you take a drug, the drug binds to receptors, the receptors are activated, things happen inside the cell, and the brain really makes new chemicals because this receptor is being activated. The brain on drugs is a different brain. It's chemically different. It's chemically changed. Okay? So that's a great realization, because you'd say, well, all you got to do then is restore the old balance and you got somebody unaddicted. And I think that may be true. But you know what we found? And people didn't believe it at first. We found that these changes, these chemical changes in the brain, last a long time. We're talking about months and months, maybe years. So I think that this is why drug addiction is a chronic relapsing disease, because the changes that are caused are very long-lasting in the brain. It's just the way the brain is made. Those changes are very long-lasting.
Are they structural?
Some are.
And functional?
Sure. In the brain, structure and function are just about merging, sort of. Mm-hmm. So the long-lasting nature of changes of these changes has helped us understand that this is not like pneumonia, where you take antibiotics for 10 days and you're done and you go back to work. This is a situation that you live with for months and months, and that you're going to have to cope with for a lot longer time than being in bed for 10 days. I think that's a big deal. It gives us a perspective on the nature of the disorder, which translates into how we understand it and how we're going to treat it. So I think these things are big, big deals. The behavioral world, something that, you know, I never thought, which I now greatly respect, has come up with some interesting things. You know about Pavlov's dog. Pavlov, you know, rang the bell, and the dog ate and salivated. And now you just ring the bell, dog salivates. Of course, human beings are the same. And addicts are sometimes classically conditioned, like Pavlov's dog. By this I mean that you take drugs with the same people sometimes in the same place, and you see the same paraphernalia, the white powder, okay? So you could be an addict. You go away to a treatment place. Walk out that hospital, you don't crave drugs at all until you see that white powder, your friends. It's like Pavlov ringing the bell. Suddenly you start craving it. It's like that treatment never happened. Mm-hmm. So we know now that treatment has to include behavioral changes, mm-hmm. extinction of old conditioning, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And these things, again, are appreciated in a whole new light now in the last 20, 30 years.
Abe Wickler at the ARC,
yes,
did papers on conditioning and thought that.
Oh, yes, right, yes. Good for you.
Well, I'm writing a book about this, but it's an interesting example of reinventing the wheel, because I do, it's a very interesting thing to me, because he could have said more or less what you just said.
Yeah, he could have said Pavlov to figure this out.
And he did. I mean, that was, you know, that was his route, obviously. But when you think about where your ideas about the reward system came from, mm-hmm. who do you think of? So where, when you say the reward system?
Yes, okay. I think in the 50s there were papers in Science on electrical self-stimulation. Mm-hmm. Was it Olds?
Like Jim Weeks or Olds? Sure.
Olds. James Olds. I think of it, a lot of it is going back to Olds.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And who he built on, I'm not sure, but there's probably somebody before him in some manner or some way. So it goes back. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But that's your...
My perception is back to Olds.
Yeah, okay. That's great.
Yeah.
Very helpful.
Now again, you see, these things are reinvented in a new light,
yes.
with new appreciations mm-hmm. of their importance. Yeah. So, you know, so now we think of addiction or the vulnerability. I mean, has all this knowledge helped us understand who might be an addict? is a teacher going to be able to point to a kid and say, I got to watch that kid, he might be an addict, that kid's fine? Well, it's more complicated than that. But all of this has led us to understand and develop the concept of risk factors. Mm-hmm. If you have a history of drug abuse in your family, it may be that your reward system is somehow tuned that you're going to get a special kick out of drugs. You know how they say antidepressants cure a chemical imbalance? Maybe drugs cure a chemical imbalance of a different kind, maybe. Maybe people are trying to self-medicate, maybe, sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that could be a risk factor. If you're classically conditioned and have been hanging around drugs, that's a risk factor. Availability of drugs is a risk factor. Peer pressure is a risk factor. And now we think of vulnerability as a series of risk factors. The more risk factors you have, the greater the possibility is that you'll go that way. And now we view the package completely, from environment down to genetic endowment. Each has its piece. Somebody spoke today and said they didn't think the genes worth nothing. They thought it was all behavior and environment. I won't say that, but that's what, you know. So everyone has their views. But now we can see, we're talking about genes expressing proteins, you know, and we're talking about an anatomical system in the brain that's, you know, and we know why it's there now. Oh, now I see why it's so powerful. Drugs can get control of your behavior because, my God, it's like sex, you know? Try and tell your teenage kids to stay away from sex. Just like, stay away from drugs, stay away from sex. Are you crazy, Ma?
So were you around when the Vulnerability Initiative was... That was a little after you, wasn't it? NIDA's Vulnerability Initiative?
Well, there was always some. Yeah, it was mostly after me, I think.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I just wondered what you made of it, whether you thought that we had gotten further with understanding individual variation.
Yeah. I think we have come hugely far in vulnerability. The concept of risk factors and adding up is a big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to talk about the addictive personality, but that was very descriptive, very vague. Now, the concept of risk factors is very concrete and sort of semi-quantitative. Still, we don't know enough to predict who will take a drug, but we can say who may be more likely than others on a statistical basis.
So is there anything that we didn't ask you that we should have?
I don't know. My first chairman at Johns Hopkins said that doing academic research was a privilege, and I never believed him. But looking back, it really has been a privilege. You know, working in an area where you develop new knowledge that impacts society, is there's just nothing like it. Makes you forget money. And even sex, I guess.
So certain rewards trump others.
Yes.
There you go. Well, that may be a pretty good place to wrap up. But thank you very much.
Thank you.